You're listening to the Mormon Expression Podcast. Find us on the web at mormonexpression.com.
Mormon Expression is made possible through your generous support. Consider a subscription or a donation today.
And thanks. It's time for the annual Listener Essay Contest.
Essays must be recorded in any audio format and be less than 10 minutes, dealing with any topic in Mormonism.
And the winner will receive a $100 prize.
Essays may be submitted by sending a message to mail@mormonexpression.com.
We look forward to hearing your entries and good luck.
And finally, the Mormon Expression annual live event will be August 6, 2011 in Salt Lake City.
It's going to be a fabulous evening filled with music and the spoken word.
Get your tickets now by going to mormonexpression.com/tickets on our website.
We look forward to seeing everybody there.
All right, welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson. And tonight, we've assembled another great panel for your entertainment. First of all the way from Arm, Utah.
Arm. Yeah.
Is Tom. Hey, Tom.
Hey, what's up, guys? Thanks for letting me participate.
Thanks for being here. And then we have Heather. Hey, Heather, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me back again.
Have you hit your number five yet?
Oh, I've lost track. Perhaps. If not, I'm coming right up on top of it.
Number five is the magic number at which time you can get a bio on the website if you've appeared
in
five.
And if you hit six, we buy you donuts.
Oh, easy there. I mean, let's not go cashing the bank in. And then we have Michael Wagstaff. Hey, Mike.
Hey, John.
Not to be confused with the other mic.
Definitely not to be confused with the other mic. We love the other mic, but I'm not him.
Yeah. Well, welcome back.
Thanks.
Okay, so tonight we're starting up a series that I've been sort of bouncing around for a long time, and I've been real excited. You know, we try to cover all the – well, let me say it this way. Mormonism is full of a lot of really bizarre – strange bits and pieces that sometimes you can't necessarily cobble together into a single podcast. You know, it's 10 minutes worth of strange, right? So, and I mean strange as in wonderful and great and all those superb things out there. So, what we talked about is having a top 10 series, and this is the first in that series, and that will give us a chance to count down the top 10 of something or the other in Mormonism. And we're planning on cranking one of these out a month so that you, our loyal listener, can learn about the top 10 whatever. So tonight we're going to start the series and talk about the top 10 bad boys of the Quorum of the 12. The top 10 apostates or excommunicants from the Quorum of the 12. I think that most people don't realize that, you know, the Quorum has a history. And probably, what, about 10% of anybody who's ever served in the Quorum of the Twelve since 1835, when it was established, have left the Quorum or been kicked out or otherwise gone their own way. And there's a lot of interesting stories there, and we're going to count them down, the top 10.
Is this where we insert the David Letterman music? You know?
I suppose. Yeah, we'll do it in reverse order. There's a long history of top 10 lists here, there, and around. So we should ride that gravy train, right?
Why not?
You got the music, right, John?
The David Letterman music?
Yeah, you got it, right?
Is there music? Don't they just play like a lot of like banging of drums and stuff? I don't know. All right. So any questions from the panel before we start off on this big list? There's actually more than 10 on here, I have to admit, because you're going to find out right with number 10.
Yeah, you combined a few but I guess we can just kind of highlight them, right? Because a lot of these guys, we could spend quite a bit of time talking about, but...
Oh, good Lord. Yes, we could.
I guess we'll just try to hit the highlights as much as we can.
All right. Let's Let's jump right in at number 10. Tied for number 10 are the Orsons, Orson Hyde and Orson Pratt. Of course, they are both, I think they're both original from the original 1835 setting up of the Quorum of the Twelve. Both of them, well, and you have to go back and realize that Joseph Smith in the early days used excommunication sort of like we would use just a verbal warning today.
Be like defriending on Facebook.
Yeah.
So ooh, like, that is brutal.
Everybody in the early days was disfellowshipped 4 or 5 times and excommunicated 3 or 4 times. So you can't go just off on being excommunicated because both these guys were in and out several times. But they get the number 10 position because they both sort of quit the church around about the same time, which is 1842. And they both quit the church for the same reason. Which is the other members of the Quorum of the Twelve or the First Presidency had had their way with their wives. So Orson Hyde, of course, famously went on a mission to Palestine, and he was gone from April 1841 December 1842. What the books don't tell you is as soon as he left, his wife Nancy moved in with Willard Richards above the printing shop. And young Willard Richards, who I believe was unmarried at the time, he goes shacked up with her for a while, and it was kind of a open, sort of dirty secret in Nauvoo. A lot of people saw the comings and goings. One author I read said that they bolted the doors and windows shut as soon as this happened. But then Joseph got a little jealous and took her for his own, Nancy, and she stopped living with Willard Richards, who of course was in the 12, and. She became one of Joseph Smith's pieces on the side.
Hey. You know, shouldn't we say that the Lord commanded Joseph Smith to take her?
Oh, that's
his wife.
That's implied.
And that she had a position of I just lost my train of thought, but she was in a position of never mind. I can't think of the term I want. That it was a good thing that like the Lord was blessing her.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
To be one life. Of Joseph Smith's wives.
This was all, yeah.
Place of honor.
This was all the Lord's work.
Of course.
So that's Nancy. And of course, Orson's wife, Sarah, also. And Sarah actually left the church years later. She went out to Utah, but left the church. But Sarah also, while Orson Pratt was in a mission in England, I believe he was at. She started shacking up with Joseph. Now, the important thing is neither Orson Pratt nor Orson Hyde knew about this until they got back. And so it's not like there were other women, you know, like Zena Huntington, where Henry Jacobs was there and present, like when Joseph married her. So there were times when Joseph would approach, you know, like the Heber C. Kimball's a famous one where he said, you know, I want to marry your wife. And Heber said it was a big test. But in these cases, these guys didn't know. And they came back and they both left the church and were going to turn state's witness. But lucky for Joseph, they both decided to repent. So that's why they're so far down on the list. They did come back.
Yeah, John, did they have wives? Did they have wives? I mean, because I know Orson Pratt had, I don't know, 10 wives of himself.
Pratt had 10
before and, after the mission. That was after the mission.
It was after. This was their introduction to the law of polygamy when they came back and found their wives had been, you know,
taken.
Yeah. I think Hyde had eight additional wives and he had 32 children. Now Hyde, interestingly enough, would have been senior, and he was senior, but Brigham Young way back in Utah shuffled them around and said, "Oh, you left the quorum," but it's really sort of a underhanded, and they put John Taylor in position. It was really sort of underhanded move because there were others who had lost their position in the quorum too. It was sort of Brigham Young.
But yeah, he would have been number 2 instead of John Taylor the second prophet here in Utah.
Yeah.
Instead of John Taylor.
So that's the Orsons. All right, let's move on to number 9. The brothers. Now, Quinn points out that when Jesus set up his Quorum of the 12 Apostles, he had 2 sets of brothers. And when Joseph set up his Quorum of the 12, he had 2 sets of brothers. And one of those sets of brothers was Luke and Lyman Johnson. They were, again, part of the original 12. And both these guys became disillusioned with the Panic of 1837. Now, things were going good. It was a little religion, and there were converts, and everybody moves to Kirtland, and then they discover like real estate, and they set up the Kirtland
Safety Society,
Anti-Banking Safety Society, and really start. They're accused of starting to ride around in carriages. And if you remember, like as early as 1834, like Joseph and his family were just destitute, and they settled down on the Johnson farm and all that sort of stuff. By 1837, things were really bad. Joseph couldn't be seen in public, and he was smuggled out of Kirtland in the winter of 38. So both these guys became disillusioned with the profit in 37 when the bank panic came all across the country and banks collapsed. And they signed Warren Parrish's statements and called the profit lie by revelation, swindle by revelation, cheat and defraud by revelation, and runaway by revelation was the line from that statement that they both signed. Let's see. Lyman actually came back to the church, but he received a written threat on his life from Samson Avard, and Samson, of course, was the dark and sinister leader of the Danites. So Lyman kind of hung around, you know. And let's be clear: a lot of people leave the church, but the church was sort of everything, and they had their farms, they had their homes. So it's not like they just went away. Not like they moved to Cincinnati or anything. So Lyman was still threatened by the Danites. That's what made him turn, and he was further associated with the anti-Mormons during the Utah War, or not the Utah War, the Mormon Wars in 38. Lyman was associated with them. Luke, his brother, was actually rebaptized in 46 and died in Utah in 61. So, but Lyman stayed out.
Now, I have in my notes that he became a lawyer in Iowa, and that he drowned in an accident on the Mississippi River.
Danites.
Lyman?
Really?
I doubt it.
Well, what I have down here is that Wilford Woodruff said that he did not go hang himself like Judas, but he did go drown himself, and the river went over his body while his spirit was cast into the pit, where he ceased to have power to curse either God or his prophet in time or in eternity.
You say Wilford Woodruff said that?
Yes.
That's pretty rough.
Then it must
You're talking about Lyman.
Yeah.
Yeah, because Luke came back.
Yeah, Lyman did not. Well, Yeah, he eventually went to Iowa, and according to the Journal of Discourses, his life was never good or happy again. But I noticed that, you know, like Judas, he went and killed himself some 20 years after the event. So, of course, that's a fair, you know, correlation.
Now, I have to take exception with you saying Judas killed himself, because in the Journal of Discourse, Heber Kimball said that Judas was killed by Peter.
I know so little.
So all good Mormons know that Judas was killed by the other 12. All right. So I just called you not a good Mormon.
I'm not a good Mormon, so.
All right, let's move forward. Number 8. He's kind of a disappearing guy, John E. Page. He was baptized in 1833 and ordained apostle in 38. He was one of the replacements. So, you know, we lost half the quorum of the 12 after the panic, the bank panic, and he came in, and he was a part of Joseph's inner circle, but he was constantly being reprimanded, and he was actually supposed to go with Hyde to Palestine. Probably lucky he didn't, or his wife would have been passed around. But Johnny Page,
he refused to go. He stayed with his wife in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, yeah.
This isn't the guy that left his wife, and she was 3 days, like just had a baby, and they had 3 days of food or something. Where did I read that?
I read that too, and now I can't remember who that was.
I think that was Lyman. No, good, let's keep going. I can't remember who it was, but that was a nasty thing. He left his wife. Joseph asked him to go, and like 3 days later, or he only had food for 3 days, and his wife was pregnant or something. I mean, it was like, hello.
Yeah, we forget how real this was. And, you know, the word cult gets bandied around quite a bit. You know, I keep saying the church isn't a cult today, but it was really culty at the time. And, you know, people were waiting for Jesus to come, and, you know, they would leave their families and da 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 da.
So how many times are you going to call the church culty or cultish and tried to say, I'm not saying it's a cult.
Until it sticks, Tom. Until it sticks.
Just checking.
You know, and there's some that theorize, and I think it's a good theory, that if you read the history of the early members of the Quorum of the Twelve, there are those who would leave their families and those who wouldn't. And so what we did is we selected for sort of like bastards who didn't have strong connection to their wives. So because a lot of them just said, no, I'm not going. And I'm not going to leave my pregnant wife with no food. And there are a lot of members who did that. But the ones who would obey and who were willing to like give all that stuff away and hand their wives over to the prophets, and thus you get all the nonsense that happened in Utah in the 50s, because, I mean, these were like, I don't want to use the word psychopath, but I
No, honestly, John, that when I went through these guys, that was the psychology of religion was something that I found myself weak and asking the question, why do these people do this stuff?
Because normal people were selected out. They were weeded out.
Yeah, but to what – I mean, okay, so, you know, afterlife, paradise-type glory is a reward, but, I mean, you got to endure a lot of crap to hang with Joseph Smith. That's
– Well, and we know from other, you know, people have written about religion, other experiences, and it's sort of a Stockholm sort of thing. The more you give up,
yeah,
you sort of bond yourself to your file leader and – You know, it's like the Millerites. You know, when Jesus didn't come in 44, some of them left, but some of them became stronger in their fervor. And, you know, because you give up so much for the religion, you sacrifice so much that you just can't get out. You'll meet people in any ward. I guarantee you, if you look, you can find 20 people who, if you got like down with a bottle of scotch, you could get them to admit that they don't believe in the church, but that it's just the cost of leaving is too high. And that, and the cost for these guys was tremendous, you know?
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to mention, we were building off women and, you know, when Mike was saying that, this woman was almost 3 months pregnant or was pregnant.
It was Lyman White and it says his wife being ill with a 3-day-old child and he was asked to go.
Okay.
Yeah.
When I tried to wrap my mind on how all that works and stuff like that, I don't think they looked at women too close to being equal. I mean, weren't a lot of them kind of traded life like livestock? I mean,
well, they became that way in the Nauvoo period and up until, you know, like the end of polygamy. Yeah, women's rights suffered tremendously.
Because I'm surprised at the times when I read about a father would kind of give the rights of his daughter away. I'm like, wow.
And they'd bargain with brothers and stuff for women. And yeah.
Sure. I just don't think that women were looked very highly on back then. And
they weren't allowed to own land in general society or vote. I mean, it wasn't like now. I mean, it seems more extreme now because we're, you know, comparing women in normal society to, say, you know, fundamentalists down in Arizona. But back then, it wasn't that much stranger. Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
Yeah, and you know, and Mormonism has had its times, its moments, and it seems that things were better. You know, they were leaving the women back there. It's true. But things were okay up until Emma got uppity and tried to turn the Relief Society, you know, on to rooting out this polygamy and the spiritual wifery. And, of course, it was shut down for 20 years. You won't read that in any of the histories of the Relief Society. Joseph Smith disbanded it. It was 20 years later before it was restarted. And women's rights at that point, because Joseph was in deep, were set back a long ways in Mormonism. All right, so back to number 8.
Page.
So Page was loyal up until the martyrdom, and actually was with the saints until they started leaving Nauvoo. And in 46, he hooked up with the Strangites. He was one of the Quorum of the Twelve, but he decided that Jesse James. I never remember if it's James Jesse. I think it's James.
Yeah, James Strang.
James Jesse Strang. He convinced Johnny Page to follow him, and Brigham Young excommunicated him in 46. And he followed with Strang for quite a while until Strang started really wigging out. But later he joined with the Hendrickites, which are the Temple Lot. And then I think after that he joined up with the Reorgs. And so Page sort of was the apostle that went with the other movements.
Yeah, we shouldn't discount Strang too much. That dude really got a lot of people to follow him, at least in the short time period that he kind of swayed a lot of people. I mean, because he had scriptures and revelations and visions and everything, and a lot of people went after Strang.
Well, that's why Page is so important. I mean, I dare say that 95% of the people listening have never heard of him, and one of the reasons they've never heard of him is because he's been marginalized, because this is key. He was a sitting apostle, and he was a very early member, 33. He had survived through the panic of 37. He had survived through the expulsion in Missouri. He was in the inner circle in Nauvoo. You know, he was a big time player, and he left and followed. It wasn't as clear cut as it seems today that Brigham Young should be the one to follow. And there was a lot of confusion. And I mean, if you imagine today, if, like, you know, Dallin Oaks followed after some guy in Ephraim who translates some records, it'd be something akin to that.
Well, and you'd mentioned that he was kind of an insider. So he was a hidden polygamist, and he was a member of the Council of 50.
Yep.
So yeah, he was definitely in on the in.
Okay, number 7 is my personal favorite apostle from the early stages. William Smith, the younger brother of Joseph. He was a fiery guy, even more so than Joseph Smith. As a matter of fact, one time in a elders quorum meeting, like in the early days, he and Joseph got in a fist fight. Mm-hmm. He was constantly getting involved in sex scandals all his life. The guy liked the ladies.
Your favorite guy, John.
Well, he had a lot of sexual misconduct and people bringing charges up against him, and he was in and out. And most of the people didn't like him. But Joseph would always, like, come to his rescue. This is another thing that's sort of been buried. Joseph taught firmly in the patrilineal, that the priesthood was given to some families by right, and that the Smiths had the priesthood by the right of their lineage. And, you know, he put all the, you know, Hiram was going to be the next prophet. William was called a prophet, seer, and revelator. He talked about his father having his position as patriarch because of his right. There's pretty good evidence, although we don't want to go down the forged one, but there's pretty good evidence that Joseph Smith III was in line to receive the prophetship if Joseph had survived. So William Smith was this bad boy all the way along, and he was excommunicated pretty quickly in 45. Now, when the sexual scandal broke, the first one, like in 41, 42, associated with John C. Bennett, things are really dark here. Like, a lot of documents are missing, and there's a lot of accusations going back and forth. But
wait, hang on a second. So was he in cahoots with John C. Bennett? Were they, like, what, he was wrapped up in that scandal?
He was. And what appears to be happening is that this is absolutely clear. John C. Bennett and William Smith would go to women, at least these two guys, and probably more, would go to women and say, there's a secret doctrine of spiritual wifery, which says that as long as we, you know, pledge to each other, or whatever he would say to seduce them, then it's okay. And they were more like swingers than they were sort of the later polygamy that came on to follow. In my ill-informed opinion, Joseph Smith and some of the others were doing the same thing. And then they sort of became more concrete after they threw John C. Bennett under the bus as he started naming names. But William was caught up, and William confessed and, you know, said, oh, I'm sorry. But he kept that stuff up. And of course, he was excommunicated in 45. And then in 48, he started a church as the guardian for Joseph Smith III. This is a precursor to the reorganized church, but he sort of set himself up. And William was in and out of a lot of the, you know, he was associated with the Strangites and associated with the reorganites. And Lucy really loved William. William was the only one left, and she was like William's fiery protector. So he was there all along. And I know there were instances where he had sent letters back and forth to Brigham because it was in the late 50s, I think, maybe you guys can correct me, that Brigham decided he wanted to collect the full set. So he sent his guys after all these old guys who had left the church, try to get them into Utah. And he never made a headway with William.
Well, I don't know the validity of this, but I did find something that said that when he started the church to kind of be a protector waiting for Joseph Smith's son to be old enough to take over, that he actually claimed that that was the center of Mormonism, excommunicated Brigham Young, and basically, you know, was trying to get people to come back to Illinois.
Yeah, it's kind of like the Avalon Papacy. They all excommunicated each other.
Mm-hmm. He also fought in the Civil War.
William did?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that. I guess you kind of had no choice, but... Mm-hmm. All right, let's go to number six. Number six, Amasa. Amasa is how you pronounce it. Now, the Lymans, they're one of those power families you've never heard of. Three generations, Amasa and his son and his grandson all served in the Quorum of the Twelve, and two-thirds of them were excommunicated. So maybe the church has learned its lesson. All you Lymans out there, you're no longer in favor of the church. He was an early, I'm not sure when he joined the church, didn't write that down, but he was in Zion's camp and was in the 70 and 35. And, he was put in the Quorum to replace Orson Hyde in 42, created sort of embarrassment when Orson Hyde came back. And there was a while there was 13 members of the Quorum of the 12, cause they didn't really fire him, but they didn't really get rid of him either. He stayed. Now we're sort of getting away from those early problems in the church. And he stayed faithful. He went out to Utah and all that kind of stuff. But something happened in Dundee, Scotland in 1862. And he gave this speech in which he denied the necessity and the fact of the atonement of Jesus Christ, is a language that comes up all the time. I think that was quoted from Wilford Woodruff or something. It's B.H. Roberts who was quoting Wilford Woodruff's journal who said that. So... to me, he was the first real, well, Orson had some, but he was the first real heresy, the first real heretic. And if you think about Mormonism, how Mormonism has this this uneasy tension with the doctrine of grace, that works are necessary. And in the early church especially, they really, it was more works. And that's why you get blood atonement and some of those early weird doctrines that came out. And I think, in my mind, Lyman just sort of took it to its natural conclusion and said, I have the quote here from a passage that he said. This is Lyman talking. "We may talk of men being redeemed by the efficacy of Christ's blood, but the truth is that the blood has no efficacy to wash away our sins. That must depend on our own action." So it's really that we have to work our way into heaven. We have to get these ordinances. We have to do all these things. We have to be obedient. We have to get plural wives. We have to do all this stuff. And that was Lyman's heresy.
But if...
Yeah, and... Sorry, Heather.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think it should be clear that that happened in 1862, right, when he was in Scotland.
Yeah.
And then nothing really happened until about 5 years later when he was brought up before the Quorum and confronted about what he had said. But the key is it wasn't exactly a slip of the tongue, right?
Right.
I mean, it wasn't exactly he just kind of got caught up and he's like, yeah, so the atonement's really not that big a deal.
Right.
And because later, as I'm sure you'll probably mention, he talks about it again.
Well, he apologized.
Yeah,
he made some serious effort to apologize to the Quorum. I mean, and the prophet to say, "Hey, no, I realize my doings. I'm sorry."
And then he did it again. Yeah. Then he was talking about it again.
Yeah. The historians all sort of scratched their head about why it was 5 years, but there was some weird crap going over the pulpit at this time.
I think information travels a little slower too. I mean, if this was done in Scotland. I don't know, 5 years maybe.
Well, but Charles Rich and George Buchanan were out there with him, so he had handlers, I guess. But I do think that the role of Jesus Christ was really in question in this phase in the doctrine, because at this point Brigham Young had separated the persons of Jesus Christ from Jehovah. You know, now now, you know, after Jesus the Christ and Talmage sort of knitted them back together. But for Brigham Young, those were two separate guys. So you got like Elohim and you got Jehovah and you got Jesus, and it's just this big cluster. And I think it came under the radar because it was just like one more strange log on the fire.
I'm trying to figure out how it's a natural conclusion, though, because how do you recover from your sin if there's no atonement to cleanse you of your sin?
Yeah.
Your work.
Yeah, you had to work for it.
So you do it yourself. It's like a balance.
Yeah, most of it falls on your own shoulders.
So it's like a scale. You're trying to get more good than bad?
I guess. I didn't read his talk. I don't know if there's any.
Wouldn't it fall under, you know, the nowadays kind of slogan, do, you know, the Christ's atonement will cover you after you've done
all that
everything
you
can physically possibly do.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why it's sort of a weird, you know, it's sort of like the mind body do list where people say everything is mind, everything is body.
I like to think of it as a checklist, and I used to argue this a lot, but if you do the checklist, then you're in. If you don't do the checklist, then it would be more of the grace standard. But in Mormonism, you have a checklist.
Yeah.
You have to get baptized. You have to, you know, I mean, you don't have to go on a mission, but you have to go to the temple, you know, and then you get married. And if you don't do this,
then you're out.
You're out. You're not on the same level as everybody else. So do the checklist, and what do you need Christ for then?
Yeah.
I thought it was also interesting that this guy, as far as I could tell, was one of the few that got cut off or excommunicated for doctrinal reasons. Because there was quite a few, and you'll even mention this, John, that kind of had their rogue ideas, and they still kind of stayed in. None of them really got excommunicated, but messing with the atonement of Christ back then, that was a no-no, I guess.
Well, on the rogue ideas, a fascinating study, and it goes beyond the scope of this podcast, is Orson Pratt. Because he was constantly in trouble for saying things that were unorthodox. But the irony of it is now the church has virtually adopted every single one of his positions. And, you know, he was on the side of where the church ended up and against Brigham Young and his cronies, but all of Brigham Young stuff has been discarded. So that's a sort of an interesting sideline in the church history. Okay, number five, Lyman White.
Oh, yeah, this was my favorite.
He was ordained an apostle in 41. So this is about the time right after, you know, there was a second expulsion from Missouri. And this is when they're coming into Nauvoo. And he was sort of there's a lot of guys that Joseph Smith started associating with at this time. You know, you have like Wild Bill Hickman. You have Porter. I want to say Polygamy Porter, that's the drink. Porter Rockwell. Porter Rockwell, of course, was one of the original six. But, you know, it's a point we come to time and time again. The church was on the frontier. And these were some rough guys sometimes. And if you read, like, encounters with the saints from more, like, educated people from the East, they always pointed that out, that they were hard-swearing, hard-drinking, like wild frontier people. And you watch the movies that BYU puts out for the church these days, and it's always like light organ music in the back, and they look like something from a like Pride and Prejudice or something like that. That's not the way it was. But Lyman White, he was one of the 12, and he claims that Joseph Smith gave him a special commission to go to Texas. Now, you have to remember that we sort of back history up, and we sort of think that they were inevitably going to the Rockies. But they were investigating the Rockies, they were investigating California, they were investigating the Oregon Territory and Texas. And Texas and the Rockies were both, you know, going into Mexican territory. So it was sort of, we're done with the U.S. government. They're not giving us any protection. We need to go out. And they started negotiation with and he was at the Alamo. Do you guys remember who it was? Anyway, they started negotiation with whoever was the leader of Texas to look for a place to move the entire Mormon settlement. And Lyman White was in charge of this, a member of the 12. So after the martyrdom, that, you know, Joseph gave him and said, I want you to go down. I want you to take some people. I want you to settle Texas.
Now, hey, to interject, isn't there documentation of that, or is it just hearsay that Joseph Smith told Lyman to let's go. The goal is to eventually settle Texas.
That I'm not sure of, but I do know that Brigham Young gave it enough credence that he let him go with George Miller, who was one of the early bishops, and they took the Pine Company. Now, the Pine Company was a group of Mormons who had been up in Wisconsin to cut wood and float it down the river, both for economic reasons and to give them building materials. So that gave Lyman White his sort of foundation settlement, and they all went down to Texas. We have a lot of, like, you know, and they were somewhere outside of Austin, and they kind of moved around, but Lyman White was a hard drinker, and he walked around with a pistol on his side, and he was just a regular, like, right straight out of the movies, frontier cowboy. And in 1948, there were a lot of communications went back and forth. Brigham Young was trying to get White and his followers to go up to Salt Lake. And White always said, I'm here by revelation. This is where Joseph told me to go. This is where I'm supposed to be. And in 1948, he published a pamphlet questioning Brigham Young's right to lead the saints.
Called him a pretender to the crown.
Yes. And Brigham Young promptly excommunicated him. White became a follower of William Smith, but then he set himself up and eventually got his own 12 apostles down in Texas, and they even set up their own version of the endowment, which is sort of interesting because the other restoration movements never really did that. But then Lyman White, it just sort of fizzled out and eventually died off.
Yeah, he started a temple in Zodiac, Texas, and they moved because of economic hardship to a place called Mormon Mill, spelled Mormon spelled with an A. Mm-hmm. But as soon as he died, everybody kind of dispersed. It didn't keep going.
Yeah.
And the sad part is there's really no marker for his burial anymore.
Yeah.
What was up with I saw a blurb about his being accused of teaching false doctrine, and then he was tried before the High Council in Far West and found guilty, and I didn't get a grasp on actually what that was, and wondered if anybody heard or read anything about that more.
I skipped over those. If you took all the 14 guys on our list, that probably happened a grand total of 70 times. It was a really common occurrence, and in their defense, if you read the Doctrine and Covenants in Book of Mormon, it's not real doctrine rich. And so the guys were just sort of making it up as they went along, and if two of them contradicted each other, they bring up one for trial. And
so, well, in a legal setting, you actually have a law that you're prosecuting on that law. And you're, like you're saying, the doctrine was weak. That must have been a kangaroo court. I couldn't get a grasp on what actually happened at those trials, at being tried before the High Council.
And you have to also recall that they were really into public shaming. If somebody did something like they upset Joseph Smith, they'd have to get up and confess their sins. And if they thought or caught somebody committing adultery, they would talk about it openly. If you read the Doctrine and Covenants, it says, you know, you should confess your sins before the congregation. They really believed that at the time. So everything was sort of way out in the open. All right, number four, the one and only Thomas B. Marsh.
Yeah, so he left over some milk scraps, and that's it. So what's number three?
So, of course, the milk scrap story keeps coming up, which was apparently invented by George Albert Smith, who gave that story over the pulpit years later. There is no evidence whatsoever historically for it, and unfortunate for George A. Smith, Marsh actually wrote a signed affidavit where he explains exactly why he left the church on October 21st, 1838. And he left the church because he was alarmed that Mormons had formed mobs, were expelling all the non-Mormons from Daviess County, were stealing property and burning homes. Now, we talk about the Mormon War. Once again, this is church propaganda. It talks about all that stuff going one way. And I am not here to dismiss the Missourians. They were a rough lot. But so were the Mormons. And they were both raping and pillaging through the countryside. Yeah. They were burning and killing, and not as much killing as you'd think. But
that's a pretty big accusation. You're saying that the Mormons were raping.
Okay,
and
I don't have any evidence. I meant raping the countryside.
Just plunder, pillage.
Plunder and pillage. That's what I meant.
But marched to a town called Gallatin.
Soften up your words already.
But
sorry.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say they marched to a town called Gallatin, raided homes and stores, burned everything down, dispersed the people, just like the church claims happened to the Mormons constantly.
And it did happen to the Mormons constantly, but this was a two-way war going on here. And the bishop's storehouse, we have many, many accounts, was full of stolen goods. Saddles and animals, and they would go in, they'd bust in, they'd steal everything they could, and they would take it and run. And so would the Missourians. It was going back and forth that way. The Mormon war was really nasty. And so a lot of people left the church over that because they said, you know, the Danites were doing their raids under Samson of Ard, and they were playing dirty too. So it's not like these praying saints, you know, you always see the pictures of Hans Mill, and Hans Mill was a terrible tragedy, don't get me wrong, but there were also Mormons out there raiding and burning. And that's why Marsh left the church. Now, Marsh, unfortunately, I talked about sort of the cult aspect. And, you know, if you had everything invested in the church and the church owned all the property and, you know, you left the church, you would lose your farm and sometimes your family and just everything you had. In 1857, he made his way back to the Saints. He was impoverished. He was destitute. And Brigham Young took him back in, and this is Brigham Young's words from the pulpit. I think they're great, so I want to read them. So Brigham Young, he has told you that he is an old man. Do you think that I am an old man? I could prove to this congregation that I am young, for I could find more girls who would choose me for a husband than can any of the young men. Brother Thomas considers himself very aged and infirmed, and you can see that he is, brothers and sisters. What is the cause of it? He left the gospel of salvation. What do you think the difference is between his age and mine? 1 year and 7 months to a day, and he is 1 year, 7 months, and 14 days older than Brother Heber C. Kimball. Mormonism keeps men and women young and handsome, and when they are full of the Spirit of God, there are none of them but what will have a glow upon their countenances. And that is what makes you and me young, for the Spirit of God is with us and within us.
You know what?
How is it that right after that he didn't get a bunch of high fives and chest bumps?
Wait. There's one more sentence I have to read. When Brother Thomas thought of returning to the church, the plurality of wives troubled him a great deal. Look at him. Do you think it need to? I do not, for I doubt whether he could get one wife.
Check out that loser.
As you were
public humiliation.
That, all I could think is, why don't they tell that part in the Beehive House tour?
That
speech, why don't they?
Polygamy keeps you young and spry, and the young women are all salivating over the Brigham Young.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hey, but I want, moving away from that for a second, there's a little sentence on Thomas B. Marsh in the Wikipedia page that I was wondering if you could clarify. It says, after Marsh moved to Utah and rejoined the Latter-day Saints, he looked back at his decision to leave the church with regret, recanting his 1838 affidavit. Is that true?
As far as I know.
Yep, as far as I know.
So this affidavit that he wrote, he later denies.
Sure, yeah.
Okay.
And also he died a pauper in Ogden a few years later.
Tom, I think you gotta emphasize that. There's a bigger picture there because am I wrong? All these guys returned to the church.
Not all of them.
A huge percentage. In some shape or form.
Yeah, I think
they may not have come back to the LDS or but maybe to the RLDS.
This was their glory days, and he was without family. He had nothing. And I told you that Brigham Young sort of sent out the word through the missionaries that, hey, we're bringing people back. Come back. Because this is when Brigham Young was still worried at this time in 57 that when Joseph Smith III sort of ascended to power, that he would question. And you have to remember that in the early years, Brigham Young said that he wasn't the president of the church, that he was only sort of holding that position. He was only the president of the Quorum of the Twelve. Right. And so it wasn't clear even for a lot of years that Brigham Young was the de facto leader. We're back reading that into history. So Brigham Young, in my mind, believed the more of these guys he could gather up, and if they don't have anything to their name, and he says, yeah, we'll take care of you. You know, you just gotta, I mean, here, public, Brigham Young was publicly humiliating him. So he's obviously not a man who is in good position at that time. But the things that were in the affidavit, are well established through many historical sources. It's not like we just have that affidavit. We know the Mormons were raiding. I mean, there's no question about that. So when you say the Mormons,
I mean, not to throw the entire umbrella over Mormons in general sense. I mean, there were a division of the Mormons that were doing that, sure.
Well, the Mormons had a leadership, and the leadership was aware of it and was ordering the raid, so...
Well, and it's not like the church membership was however many million they claim it is now.
Yeah.
So...
Okay. All right, so they're constantly lying from beginning to end. Okay.
Well, that's not... Okay, Tom, you're not guilty of the raids. I absolve you.
John has spoken.
No, I'm obviously there's going to be people who are unaware of them, but I think one of the ploys that historians and apologists have used is to try to say, oh, this was just a little minor thing in the dark. But when these guys are rolling in carrying all this loot, it's when it's in the bishop's storehouse where everybody's going to get their, you know, their cheese or whatever, it's not like you can hide it.
Yeah, but if there was just a small percentage of the church leadership that knew what was going on and they just kind of, I don't want to tell anybody what's going on, instead of the entire leadership and they all looked at each other like, yeah, let's not only encourage this kind of behavior, but let's stand behind them. Let's help them when we can. And that's,
I think that's two different things. I don't think there's any good evidence that the leadership was unaware or anybody in the leadership was unaware.
Also, I think that we ought to keep in mind what it was like back then. They thought Christ was coming back in their lifetimes. They thought that they were in the last days. You know what I mean? And I mean, the opening story in the Book of Mormon is Nephi cutting off the head of Laban. You know what I mean? It's better that one man perish than a whole nation dwindle in unbelief. So if they're living in that kind of very palpable environment, then they would view what was going on in that time in a completely different way than we do. You know what I mean? Those are the minions of the devil or whatever. And we're trying to fight this war until Christ comes. And, you know, I mean, it's completely different mindset.
So it's so lying for the Lord was kind of looked at in a favorable light, you think?
Oh, absolutely.
It was probably considered necessary.
Except for Marsh.
Well,
yeah, because his neighbor stole his milk striplings or whatever.
Well, essentially, when I read him, I saw him leaving on a social issue.
Well, yeah, if you count like burning down
exactly
your neighbor's house, a social issue.
Well, didn't he also leave over the salt sermon?
Well, the salt sermon is what sort of was the tinder box that sent the whole thing.
Well, I mean. Basically, what we've basically described is Thomas B. Marsh was offended. That's why he left the church.
And he wanted to sin. Okay. Yeah.
But he came back, so it's all true.
Interestingly enough, that milk stripping story is still being told as of most recently. Bednar told it at conference in 2006.
Yeah. It's a good story.
Yeah.
Well, you know, let's talk a little bit about that story. The reason it's so juicy is because it's the wily woman. He's following a woman to his own.
It's like Samson and Delilah.
The story has him. Yes, exactly. The story has him like this. He's head of the quorum. He's destined to be the prophet and he's righteous. And it's his gossipy, backstabbing, stealing wife. It fits that Mormon narrative of the, you know, the Book of Mormon, the Bible. Women are harlots and thieves, you know?
Oh, yeah. This is a Lifetime movie just waiting to be written. Absolutely.
Women are temptress. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, anybody out there, name one positive character who's a female from the Book of Mormon.
The mother of...
Sariah?
No, all she does is bitch and moan the whole time.
That's true.
What about the mothers of the stripling warriors, dude?
And what about Nephi? Did Nephi's wife complain?
I thought Nephi was a homosexual. Wait, No, you notice that the only positive characters you can name, you guys can throw at me, have no names. They're not named characters.
Well, yeah, ones that weren't mentioned or
yeah, sir, not appearing in this film.
Because they were traded like livestock back then too.
I can't think of any.
Number three, William McClellan.
This one's my favorite.
Really. Now, the favorite part about William McClellan for me is he had this set of journals that everybody thought was lost, and that when Hoffman was blowing people up in Salt Lake City, he was in negotiations with the church. The church was trying to buy them off of Hoffman. This is where things were falling apart. And the whole time they were in the church's damn
they
vault.
They had them, yeah.
They didn't even know that. They didn't even know they had them. McClellan is an interesting cat, and it would take a long time to take him apart. He was probably the smartest guy in the quorum, probably the most educated, and he had challenged Joseph Smith on some obvious things. Like at some point, he had challenged Joseph Smith saying, I don't think your revelations are really, I think you might be making those up. And Joseph challenged him back to write his own, and then he came back and said he couldn't do it.
He seemed to me as one of the few guys that totally got under Joseph Smith's skin.
He did it multiple
times. And Joseph Smith was like, I mean, there's documentation where Joseph Smith started insulting him.
Likened him to an ass in the Bible, the talking ass in the Bible.
But one thing that's interesting is we have his journals now. They have been published, and they're a fascinating read. And he was really sort of instrumental in the early growth of the church. He joined back in 31, and he was a big player all the way along. Now, he said some things that I like he went through the Kirtland Temple, and he became very disappointed. That was sort of the first part of his disappointment, because he said that Joseph had promised that they'd get knowledge when they went through the endowment. He said, I didn't learn anything. So he's the first one to say that. And
he was just brutally honest. He was just
so he tried to get back in 37, and he like kept hanging around. He was in Missouri, and the reason he gets the ranking of number three is he was sort of an agitator when the 37 collapse happened and all that stuff. And you have to remember, I wrote down this tidbit that I read. 15% of all the membership and 1/3 of all the general authorities left in 37. So it was a huge blow. But he was 20 miles outside of Far West, and he became confederate with the mobs. And he was probably the guy who went and fingered all the leaders of the church and said, that's him, that's him, that's him, that's him. And there's accounts in the journals of Rigdon talks about it, and Cowdery talks about it, that when they were like caged, when they first got captured after the Mormon War, that McClellan was there in camp, sporting around and saying some nasty things. So McClellan gets the position of number three because really he was sort of one of the principals in turning against the Mormons and turning them over to the Missouri mobs.
Yeah, and he also got sucked in with Strang, and then he went to Hendrick, so he was a Hendrickite for a while, and he gave tours of the temple lot until he was really old.
He bounced around for a long time. Once again, everyone should go read his journal. Fascinating.
What are those journals? I haven't read those, John.
It's just the journal of William McClellan.
William McClellan.
Yeah,
William.
Buy him at Desert Book. Used to be able to.
One thing that I thought was a little interesting as I was going through some of my research on this, I was thinking, I wonder if some of the temple work has been done for some of these apostates like recently. And McClellan is one of them that has had his temple work redone in the last 20, 30 years.
Yeah. If you look in the back of D. Michael Quinn's books, Origins of Power and Extension of Power, he's got little bios of all these guys, and he has included in there when they did their temple work. Some of them it was really quick. Some of them it was they let them soak for a while.
So yeah, these are all apostates back in the day, but they're all good now.
Yeah, they're all good now. All right, number two. Let's get into the big two, the final. Richard R. Lyman happens to have the distinction of being the last guy excommunicated from the Quorum of the Twelve. He was excommunicated in 1943. Richard was the grandson of Amasa. Is that how we decided we say it? Amasa? Mm-hmm.
Amasa.
And I forgot to write down the one in between. There was one in between who was also in the Twelve, who wasn't excommunicated.
I should have just named him Lyman.
Richard
Johnson.
Richard was ordained in 1918 at the age of 48, and he married Anna Jacobs in 1925, now as his second wife. Now, when we say married, he wasn't married by anybody, apparently. So really, Anna was his mistress.
Well, they supposedly did some sort of ceremony in secret.
Yeah, yeah. Kind of like Cold Mountain or something like that.
Well, I was thinking of Braveheart. That's what.
So he kept Anna as a kept woman for 27 years. They separated not until 1952, which was 9 years after he was excommunicated. And then after that, they rebaptized him in 54, and he died in 63. So, you know, this he's number two because this is not very well known, and this is a hugely embarrassing thing for the church. There are a lot of people today who are alive, when there was a practicing polygamist in the Quorum of the 12 Apostles. And you start thinking through that. So he's got a mistress for all those years. What about all the stuff he did? Does that all count? If that all counts, what does that say about apostasy? Is apostasy even possible? If everybody he ordains and all the temples he dedicates and all that kind of stuff, it's valid, even though he's sporting a mistress.
Well, God sorts that out,
John. It's a huge problem for the church anyway. I mean, even down to the micro level of if a man is drinking and baptizes his son, is his son actually baptized?
Right. Yeah, this is one of those things where you know that a general authority was brought these situations and he went to pray about it and he just left the room with a headache.
Yeah. Yeah, because I mean the church will make you keep baptizing. There's baptisms I've heard about where there's kids who are like, you know, like I don't know, they're handicapped. And they keep popping their toe out, and they'll keep dunking them in and dunking them in and dunking them in because, damn it, if that toe comes up. But this guy's banging Anna for 27 years, and everything's okay. I mean,
he was married, right?
No, he's not married. He's not married by Mormon standards. He's not married by
legal standards. If he said I do, she said I do. Whether there was people there or not, they're married. Whatever.
John, that's big love standards. Hey, did anybody find any Tribune articles or anything? I mean, because this is recent. This is.
I found some stuff, but I didn't have time to go digging and, like, what do they call that? Do my due diligence and double check it.
Well, John said, you know, there are people. I mean, my dad was alive when this guy was, you know, doing his thing. And so, what was the publicity of it? I mean,
it was all hush hush. It was really undercovers and.
Well. From what I found, Joseph Fielding Smith and Harold B. Lee were following him around, digging up information on him, and they had the chief of police arrest him, wearing his woolly garments and his uncombed hair in bed with the mistress. So, I mean, wow. I think it was probably big news here in Salt Lake City, but...
I think it was squashed. It's been a while since I've really looked into the details of this, but...
Well, it's very possible. It was probably, you know, the chief of police was probably Mormon.
Chief of police at the time might have been Skousen.
True.
I have to look that up. But yeah, you know, Cleon Skousen was the chief of police of Salt Lake for a lot of years.
Yeah.
And I found one more thing that David O. McKay helped him come back to the church and be rebaptized, mm-hmm. and that he was never restored to apostleship or even given the Melchizedek priesthood, and that he passed the sacrament with the deacons. And that just kind of broke my heart for the poor guy. Like, how humiliating.
Well, they got to humiliate him because they did the same.
Well, he went along with it.
But I mean, I don't even mean to belabor the point, but that never stopped me before. This is a huge problem for the church.
Yeah.
I mean, any way you go, like Tom says, this is a headache any way around it. Because how do they not know? These guys are supposed to have discernment, right? How does he get away with it? How do people like not say, you know, that Richard Lyman came at our conference and normally I feel the spirit when people, I felt nothing when he was talking. I felt nothing. That guy doesn't have the, you know, it just shows that the whole system is a system.
Or they just say, you know, I don't know. God works in mysterious ways. I'm not sure.
You know, Tom, I thought I was a little more still on the bandwagon than you, but I don't think that's the case.
Just in this podcast, you've already swayed to the dark side. Has John Larson convinced you, Heather?
No, I think I was down in the pits of hell before I joined the podcast. But like,
Heather,
I just
what do you mean bandwagon? What do you
like? I thought I still want to go to church, and I don't have any social pressure to go to church. I just want to go, and I still see positive things in the church, but. Every step along the way, it's not me, you know, jumping up and trying to defend the church. It's Tom. So I'm feeling a little.
Tom feels a duty.
Yeah.
Do I feel a duty or do I just see the error in your all ways?
Something.
You're a good man, Tom.
Yeah.
Hey, Heather, if you're not feeling any social pressure, would you mind coming back to church sooner?
Thanks,
there,
Tom.
There's your social pressure for you. All right.
Okay. let's go to the number one.
My favorite.
All of you out there, my favorite too. There's piles and piles of fun stuff going on here. The one and only John W. Taylor, son of his father, who was put in the quorum of at the age of 26 in 1884. He married Janet Woolley. Now, we talked about the Lymans being an important family. The most important Mormon family you've never heard of are the Woolleys, and which was after the Manifesto. And Eliza Roxy Wellington in 1901, and Rhonda Welling in 1901, married them at the same time. I think they're sisters. And then Elna G. Sandberg, he married in 1909, all while being a member of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles. He was a really popular guy. And this is hard to underestimate. He was one of those conference talkers everybody liked. And he is reported to have seen Jesus Christ, Wilfred Woodruff, Brigham Young, and his father, John Taylor, in the flesh, or as resurrected beings. I can't remember if you shake the hand of a resurrected being. What?
You'll feel it. If it's a messenger from God, he'll just stand and continue delivering his message.
Okay. Thank
you. If it's from the devil, he'll try to shake your hand and you'll feel nothing.
Taylor declined to sustain the first manifesto and conference. We were talking about that a few months ago on the podcast, that a lot of the guys just sat there and glowered when they read it in conference, and he refused to sustain it.
Well, he had a lot to lose.
Yeah, and
he didn't have to stop. The manifesto didn't make him stop. It just made it forbidden in the future.
And there were two. There were two that were kind of – these guys were the most sort of – over the top with there was a lot of post-manifesto polygamy, but it was John Taylor and
Matthias Cowley,
who were the two that were sort of put out to hang. Now, Taylor had been, because Congress knew, now let's go to the Smoot hearings, 1904, Congress knows that the church was wink, wink, nod, nod about polygamy. And so, Smoot was, Reed Smoot? Yeah, Reed Smoot was a member of the 12, and he was elected to be the senator for the state of Utah. And there were hearings that were pulled up by Congress to try to stop that. And they started subpoenaing all sorts of people. Fascinating. There's a great book that came out like last year, has huge segments from it. It's when Joseph F. Smith basically says that he doesn't get any revelation. But Taylor, that's a conversation for another day, but Taylor, John W. Taylor was that the brethren had pushed him up to Canada, and he started getting louder and louder, and he said, "You guys come clean or I am going to Congress and tell them the truth of what's really going on."
And he had made enemies in the 12, Francis Lyman, Heber J. Grant, Joseph F. Smith, and Reed Smoot, Rawl. Hated him.
Right. And this is the beginning of that schism that was started with John Taylor, because John Taylor had the revelation saying, you know, he had a couple revelations. You know, some are in possession of the church, some of them are probably in possession of the church, but, you know, saying the church won't lose polygamy, that and then the big schism came when, you know, the Allreds and the Woolies and all those guys got the revelation saying the church is going to go away from polygamy, but you have to keep it. You know, here I'm ordaining you guys, and that's the beginning of all this polygamous stuff we're still doing.
Well, and John W. Taylor claimed that he saw a bright light coming out from underneath the door of his father's bedroom
when
he was getting these revelations.
So
I think that happened in Farmington.
Yeah, in the underground. Now, Taylor resigned in 1905. He and Matthias were disfellowshipped or reprimanded, I can't remember, around about 1905, in response to the Reed Smoot hearings.
Now, you should make sure that he resigned from the quorum, not from the church,
yes,
right?
He resigned from the quorum. Yeah. He said, okay, if we're not going to do that. And Matthias sort of stayed with the church. But Taylor was excommunicated in 1911. Now, there are a lot of mixed accounts here. There's some people who say that Taylor became very bitter against the church and sort of sided with the polygamy underground and the fundamentalists. There are other accounts that say he was secretly rebaptized in 1916. Either way, he died in 1917.
Well, from what I found, the now fundamentalists were trying to coalesce around John W. Taylor.
Right.
And he wouldn't stand up against the church. Like, he was still – like, he wasn't bad-mouthing the church. He wasn't, you know –
Yeah, he's he supposedly still believed in the authenticity of the church, yeah.
Right. And I found that in 1916, two stake presidents tried to posthumously baptize him and do his temple work, but the church claimed that that was null and void.
But then in 19,
yeah, in 1917, the first presidency issued a statement saying that he was not baptized. But Quinn, but at least,
go ahead.
He says that he affirms that he was. He was secretly baptized under the knowledge of the church in 1916.
Well, this I found it said May 21st, 1965, he received his ordinances from the restoration and the restoration of blessings.
And I'm sure he's had it about 7,000 times since then. But
oh. So, every little dig you can get, right, John?
That's more Lyman problems. And I mean, why do they get to declare it null and void?
Because they're the first presidency.
They're receiving the revelation.
Yeah, that's just. That's why I'm not there, because I can't buy stuff like that. That's too fantastic for me.
Well, you know. According to the way the church works, you're supposed to be able to pray on it. And if you ask with an honest heart, really wanting to know, the Spirit will reveal the truthfulness of it to you.
Thanks,
so
Heather.
Fast and pray.
I'll work on that.
Hey, you've made a complete turnaround in just a few minutes there, Heather. Congratulations.
I'm trying. Except for I didn't really mean it.
Oh.
Now, I am looking up right now in Church History in the Fullness of Times.
Who's that written by?
This is the Religion 341 manual written by the church.
Ooh.
The aftermath of the Smoot hearings. I'm skipping down a paragraph. Unfortunately, two members of the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles, John W. Taylor and Matthias F. Cowley, were not in harmony with their fellow leaders regarding the scope and meaning of the original manifesto. Nor were they able to agree with the second pronouncement issued by President Smith. At the commencement of the Smoot hearings, Taylor and Cowley went into seclusion to avoid testifying in Washington, D.C. Following the Smoot hearings, these two apostles submitted their resignations from the Quorum of the Twelve. It was widely known they had performed more than a few plural marriages after the manifesto was issued. Their resignations from the Twelve did much to symbolize that plural marriage had indeed ended. 6 years later, John W. Taylor was excommunicated from the church because he had married another plural wife after his resignation. Elder Cowley, although never reinstated as a member of the Quorum of the Twelve, remained faithful in the church. Just wanted to hear you to hear what the spin doctors say.
What the correlated history of the church says.
Yeah.
That didn't sound too bad.
Well, it's just misleading. It is. Let's see. Where's that?
Did it sound too culty when you read it?
You know, it sort of tries to say, okay, there was a problem, but here, see, we took care of it. These two guys resigned. All done. Done and done. You know, when the real situation was really messy.
Oh, yeah. Well, can't argue with you there.
I think a whole podcast could be done on this guy's excommunication. I was reading this account that some guy had written about how he refused to come in and meet with the leaders of the church, and eventually when he did come in, he was cursing George A. Smith with bad health. And apparently David O. McKay was brand new at the time that all this was going on, and he was astounded at what was happening. And there's kind of this weird interplay between like the new sort of church leadership and the old sort of church leadership, where, you know, the old guys were lying for the Lord and everything's done in secret and we're not telling what's actually going on. And David O. McKay is from the new generation, thinking that everything is out in the open and simple and easy. And like, it was this really interesting dynamic that was being played out.
And that really marks the turn of the church. You know, the church under McKay was very different, but polygamy was really, litmus test of faithfulness, and the families were very interbred. The families were very established, and you know, you had
wait, interbred.
Absolutely, by every sense of the word.
Okay.
If you read through the genealogies, you know, like they would be married oftentimes to like daughters of fellow members of the Quorum of the Twelve, and the families, they were dynastic in these relationships. And they were, these families, you look at like when we've gone through McConkie, you know, they're all related to all these families, and they tie in back and forth, and
they had standards. They weren't marrying their own daughters, right?
No.
But
okay. I think he meant it more the royal way, like the Royals did it, and you know.
But my point is that was there was a time when you couldn't get into high leadership positions unless you'd taken a wife, and it was that you had shown that you were committed. It was more than, and then suddenly around about the Smoot hearings after the statehood was granted, you had to not be a polygamist, and it turned the whole thing on its head. And then the people who are like still around from the polygamy families, a la Bruce R. McConkie, became these sort of right wingers, you know, the Smiths and stuff. And but then the church pushed liberally because they had to go get new blood in. And this is where you get like the Lees and David O. McKay and some of those guys. Now, when I use the word liberal with these guys, I'm liberally using the definition, but. It did push the church in whole new directions.
In comparison.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, this was a Matthias Cowley, John W. Taylor, the Smoot hearings, the post-manifesto polygamy. This was like the crux of the church that turned the old church into the new church, and it's very important. And you have other things going on, like the Oath of Vengeance and the revamping of the temple and just this, all this strange stuff. And then this is, of course, when Talmage was commissioned to revamp the doctrine, and you have Jesus the Christ and Articles of Faith and some of those books being which we just accept naturally as the de facto doctrine of the church. But the people who were in that transitional period would have looked at Talmage's book and said, maybe, maybe not.
Well, you know, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just agreeing with John for a change. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I just finished reading Who Wrote the Bible, and it talks about how they've got these scribes who are cutting up, you know, and putting together these different accounts to make them one cohesive thing. And I'm trying to understand, like, how do they just all of a sudden go to people and say, okay, now this is the real truth. What you were, you know, practicing before, that's no longer the case. But I think just looking at Mormon history from the time Brigham Young came to, you know, Salt Lake City to now, it's not that many generations that we understand a completely different religion, and we believe completely different things about church history. So it doesn't take that long of a turnover to completely rewrite everything in the past and have people just believe and go forward as if that was what was really going on.
Well,
that articulates a lot of what I was talking about earlier in identifying the psychology of religion. I mean, we talked about it a little bit, but you're begging that question, Heather. Why are they doing this?
Because the world is modernizing, and if they don't keep up, they're going to be left behind and become like, you know, the Shakers or, you know, these other religions that just fall by the wayside and die.
But think of how much they've invested in it. I mean, polygamy was a big, big deal. And when they broke from it, well, you can't even say they broke from it. And we've been arguing this forever. It was more of a transitional thing that took 10, 20, 30, 50 years. There were still high authorities that were practicing it and even helping others hide it in secret. And it wasn't exactly something they could just break from because there was too much invested at that point.
Well, yeah, you know, Heber Grant, he died in 48, I think. He was a polygamist. Now, most of the time, he wasn't because he'd married two wives when they were young. One passed away. So most of his presidency, he was only married to one woman. But that's you only have to go back that far. And there are still guys in the Hinckley was still around when – I mean, they connect, they bridge, you know, so we're not that far removed from the polygamist.
Right.
Yeah, when was Hinckley born? In like 19...
14.
Yeah, like 1912, 1914, something like that.
Because I'm not sure when Monson came in the quorum. I have in my mind is the early 60s, like 63 or something like that.
But yeah, he was born into a completely different church and led a church that was entirely different than the one he was born into.
Yeah, it's a fascinating study.
Definitely.
And one which we try to dip our toe into this, like Heather's saying, how they managed the change and how it changed over time. I mean, look at something as recent. It was spring of 1990 when they changed the temple. And I would guess that, I don't know what percentage, but a huge percentage of Mormons today never saw the death penalties and never knew that the temple, the part of the temple ceremony was in Adamic, right? And they would deny it if you told them. You said, hey, you know, we used to give part of the temple ceremony in the Adamic language. They'd be like, come on. anti-Mormon lies. And that was only like 21 years ago.
Right. My parents were went through the temple in 1978.
Uh-huh.
And knowing what I know now, I have no idea how they just accepted that a church is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Completely changed in 1990.
Well, in 2005, they changed the washing and anointing. That is an ordinance, right? It's not just like something they're talking about. They actually changed an ordinance. How many churches did the early brethren light up for changing ordinances? How many missionaries have thrown other religions, under the bus for saying, hey, look, they've changed baptism? 2005, 6 years ago, they changed an ordinance and it just went out with a whimper.
Right. It would be as if we went from full immersion baptism to dribbling on the forehead.
It's exactly the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because the change of that ordinance, though, John, was actually a relief, I think, for the church membership on
but if
whole.
It's true, what does it matter if it's hard?
I'm sure that in the Middle Ages, it was the early Middle Ages, it was a huge relief not to dunk people in a cold river anymore and to sprinkle water on them. I'm sure the deaths by pneumonia dropped considerably. So
well, it's a slap in the face to those that have survived through the harder times and the harder ordinances and stuff like that. I mean, like the garments that used to be one-piecers and go down to your wrists and ankles.
Made out of wool.
I mean, they would just shake their head in shame seeing how the garments are nowadays.
Because they sacrifice so much for that. But I mean, that's a study in change. How you basically, my prediction is the church will continue to make major changes about every 20 years, about every generation, because then there's only so many changes you'll see in a lifetime. And I don't accuse them necessarily of having a schedule, but yeah, they'll look and see what, when they made the changes in 1990, it was widely reported that there had been a survey of members before that they had, gone through and looked and said,
yep,
there's parts that people find creepy in the temple, and they responded. And that's what's going to continue to happen.
I didn't know about that until the PBS special, The Mormons. I had no idea there was death penalties. I had no idea.
And there,
I'm just admitting the ignorance.
Well, that's the perfect example of the way that the church has been able to control, how they say it now, control the narrative.
Yeah.
When did they change that? Late 80s?
It was, I think, April of 1990.
90. Because I didn't see it.
Yeah, you and I, Mike, we came right after.
Yeah.
But it's to be had out there, and the stuff they removed is really heavy Masonic stuff. So you can go look at Masonic ceremonies and find out what they removed. I don't have any problem talking about it because it's no longer under prohibition, right? Because it's not in the temple. So
I think to the whole point of the conversation is they'll change. They'll continually change, whether it be ordinance, whether it be, whatever else program, three out from the divided church to the 3 hour block, the church will continually change.
And it'll continue to insist that it's the only church that has the right ordinances.
Well,
it'll say
to the
others
end
have
of
changed
keeping
them.
Membership though.
I just think the doctrine of apostasy, and we're getting off track, is completely untenable with the history of the church. There's no path you can make the doctrine of apostasy make sense at all. None. Period. All right.
Definitely.
Thanks for tuning in. All right. The top 10. So, in reverse order, number 10, Orson Hyde and Orson Pratt. Number 9, Luke and Lyman Johnson. Number 8, John E. Page. Number 7, William Smith. Number 6, Amasa. Well, I keep saying it wrong. Lyman White at number 5. Thomas B. Marsh at number 4. William McClellan at number 3. Richard R. Lyman at number 2. And number 1, John W. Taylor. I think the lesson is if you have Lyman anywhere in your name, you're destined for bad things.
And great things. You'll be known in history.
So there you have the top 10. And this wasn't all of them, by the way. There were others who were excommunicated and thrown out. But all right. Any parting thoughts from our panel?
I know very little about church history, and I am so excited to learn.
Well, stick around, sister. Tom, I'll give you the last word for the church.
Okay.
Perfect.
Heather would like to see you come back. Mike, don't give up on us. I know John's already given up, so.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, don't dust off your shoes or whatever. He's a friend. urge him to come back too.
Was that Dustin?
Oh, he's a friend. But if Mike Tannehill can't get to John, I don't think anybody can.
Like, I am a friend of truth. My religion is truth. So by that I am. And if they make show me that I believe something that's false, I will immediately switch my belief. I have no vestiture in anything being other than what it is. So.
So if I can nail down apostasy, then you're good.
You'll see him in church the next Sunday.
That sounded like you were issuing a challenge a little bit, John. I think you should edit that out.
Go ahead.
You're gonna have people start to challenge you all kinds of stuff.
You give me a definition of apostasy.
I just know it can't be done. I agree.
Here's the challenge
with John,
to everybody out there. You give me a definition of apostasy, and at the same time show that the church does not fulfill that requirement of being an apostasy. And then you win. Because I don't think you can, one, define it, and two, show that the church is not in that state.
I think you're opening up a whole new avenue of podcast series for Mormon Expression.
I'm ready and open for public debate. Bring it on, all you BYU guys. At least the ones that aren't in the pokey. In Israel right now.
Yeah, John doesn't want to hear anybody from Snow College.
All right.
He'll consider BYU Idaho.
Well, as always, the discussion continues. And I think when I get around to it, I'm going to put a page up where we're going to collect all of our top 10 so you can see them. But I'll have to wait till we get a couple more under our belt. As always, discussion continues on the website. Check us out there. Remember all of our fun stuff going on. You can keep up with the website on our Facebook group. That's a great place to see what's going on. We do have a mailing list that we do send out occasionally. And just check the website. There's lots of cool stuff going on. So, good night, everybody.
Good night.
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 Did you say the discussion will continue at mormonexpression.com?
I think twice. I kind of said it twice, yeah. Yeah.